Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Todd Weir, and I will be your host for the interview today. Secularism has emerged as a central category of 21st century political thought and critical theory. Following the lead of anthropologist Talal Assad, there's a growing literature that traces the complicated relationship between state policies on religion and emergent epistemologies of the secular in the modern age. Now, most studies have focused on India or the Islamic world, or they have looked at France or the United States, but the communist world has been really left out of the picture. And that is why the recent book edited by Justine Quijada and Tam Ngo is of particular interest. And today I had the pleasure of speaking to these two anthropologists about their book, Atheist Secularism and Its Discontents, A Comparative Study of Religion and Communism in Eurasia. And this book has just appeared with Palgrave. Justine Quijada is Associate Professor of Religion at Wesleyan University, and Tam Ngo is a research fellow at the Max Planck Institute for the Study of Religious and Ethnic Diversity in Göttingen in Germany. What is important about this book is really the fact that we know so little about communist secularism, and I think that listeners will enjoy learning something about the differences between Western liberal secularism as it appeared in a colonial context and in places like the United States, and the communist variant. Whereas Western models of state secularism were premised, in theory at least, on separations between religious and secular spheres and between church and state, communist regimes rejected separation and sought to rule directly over the religious realm. As the editors discuss in this interview, even after the waning of the utopian revolutionary convictions that sustained these communist regimes early on, officials in contemporary communist and post-communist states continue to intervene regularly in religious affairs. And the essays of the book, which I definitely recommend to listeners, are wonderful because they all really highlight different dynamics that are currently being generated in the interaction of religious and secular actors in places such as China, Russia, Poland, Vietnam, and in places in between. So without further ado, I would like to introduce our editors. Hello, and welcome back to New Books Network. My name is Todd Weir, and it's my pleasure today to be speaking to the authors of an interesting new book called Atheist Secularism and Its Discontents, A Comparative Study of Religion and Communism in Eurasia. And this is edited by Tam Ngo and Justine Quijada. Justine, is that the correct pronunciation?
Quijada.
Quijada. There we go. So let me just say, congratulate you both, first of all, on what I think is a very important book, because secularism is emerging as a very exciting field of critical theory, of historical anthropology, history, religious studies, and this adds a new dimension, really, to this growing literature. I think most of the literature around secularism has been developed either looking at places like France or the United States, or in the colonial context, India, parts of the particularly Islamic world. And so bringing in to the discussion the so-called Second World, or the communist states and their successor states, really is, I think, a great addition. So, and I also want to congratulate you on having not just a few interesting essays mixed in with some not so interesting essays, but I think actually every one of these essays that I've read is outstanding and I think really adds a very original interpretation. So it does actually provide a great basis for comparison, which is obviously what you've set out to do. So without further ado, Tam Ngo and Justine, I'm already forgetting how you pronounced it, Quijada, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. So just to get started, why don't you tell me physically where you happen to be at the present moment and a little bit about yourselves and, you know, how you came to this project, both individually and together.
Tam, do you want to go first? Or
Yes, please go.
Okay, well, I'm Justine Quijada, and I'm currently assistant professor in the Department of Religion at Wesleyan University. So physically, I am in Connecticut, where we just had quite a bit of snow. And but I was at the Max Planck Institute in Göttingen for 2 years, a while back now. And my research is on religious revival in a post-Soviet republic, the Republic of Buryatia, which is in south-central Siberia, just north of Mongolia. So I look primarily at Buddhist and shamanic revival, these days mostly shamanic revival, in that period. And so I came at my material very much from a Russianist, post-Soviet, Eastern European perspective, and that made for really interesting conversations with some of my colleagues at the Max Planck. So, Tam, do you want to?
Yes, and just by wonderful coincidence, Justine was sitting just at the other side of a door that separates our rooms. And I hear her talk quite loud, and I thought, hey, wait a minute, this lady is thinking a lot of things that is also going on in my mind, only that she give a different name to it, and also she plays it in different reason. Because at that time, I just graduated from my, I just finished, I defend my PhD from the VU University in Amsterdam on a topic that look at the massive Christian conversion to among the Hmong population in the border between Vietnam and China. And that that transformation is taking shape and taking place within the framework of Vietnam, which is anti-Christian secularist or atheist religious policy. And then there are so many ways that our research, Justine and I, are similar to each other. So this, we start talking to each other just very casually at lunch, and then later on the conversation grow longer, and we decide to involve other. At the Max Planck here, we have at that time a group of, well, I think considerable size of 8 postdocs, I think. Everybody work on different topic, but we take the spirit of comparison very seriously. So by talking to each other, we learn from each other's case, but we also realize the possibility to enrich our argument and discussion by just highlighting the difference and the similarities between our research, despite of regardless of where we did our research. So this book is essentially a result from this very interesting conversation that we have over the 2 years as Justine were here. Until today, comparative study is still the spirit of the Max Planck. We do a lot of research on different topic that is basically a comparison within Asia, among different Asian country, but also between Asia and Europe. And Justine and I working on this project is bridging this comparison to Europe.
Great. You know, I think for the listeners, they might not be familiar with the Max Planck Institutes. This is sponsored, I think, by the German government. There's a number of them. They work on various topics. Tom, is it purely research, the Max Planck Institute?
Yes. I can say that this is an unique setting for research. I just so lucky to get here, to be here. It is a one of the, 170-something research institute in the entire Max Planck Society. The majority of Max Planck Institute in natural science is a pure lab and pure research setting in which a researcher in natural science, they would work more closely with a leader, but in the minority Max Planck Institute like our, we have department that would follow certain theme, but in which individual researcher have so much freedom to pursue their own research, but also be in a context that we can't benefit from others other colleagues' research, but it entirely only research, no teaching, no other commitment. Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
Yeah, no, I think for people that are serious about their studies, it seems like a wonderful opportunity. So let's start talking about the book. And the first thing, obviously, that we want to clarify for listeners is the term secularism. You know, I think many people would still associate secularism with the way the term originated in the 19th century, being a term that describes non-belief or anti-clericalism or secular humanism or free thought. You know, that's how the term originated. That's how many people would assume, or that would how people would assume it functions. But really, in the context of the new literature, it's not precisely or not entirely what it means. Who would like to give us a bit more detailed idea of what you mean by secularism?
I can do that, I guess. The thing is that, as you say, as the term originally was formulated by Holyoake, it's about secular humanism, about free thinking, but it was very much for him a political project. It was about finding a common ground from which to create social reform without arguing about ultimate values and ultimate beliefs. So although he was an atheist, he was very sort of adamant, we don't care about that. We just want to find a ground under which we can move forward in a political project. And I think that meaning stays very much with secularism. The problem with the term, of course, is that every author that uses it defines it a little differently. And for us, it was very much, and I think something that is becoming a dominant definition of the term secularism is the realization that it is very much a project, sometimes an intellectual project, very often a political project. So for us, secularism was the political project of the state to create, in the communist case, the project to create a state without religion, which of course they didn't succeed in doing. But secularism then more broadly in a global sense is about political projects to ground authority or sovereignty in the human realm and thereby create sort of a political space without the influence of religion in it. And then what that looks like, of course, is different in each state that tries to engage in that project. And the value of seeing it as a project rather than like a condition, so it's both an ideology and a project, is because it lets you look at sort of like how it motivates people and states and organizations to try and do things and achieve a particular goal, even if they don't necessarily, as in the case of communist states, right? You can see what they were working towards, even if they didn't get there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, very good. So in other words, it's more than just the notion of separation in church and state. What's the relationship between the idea of separation and secularism?
Oh, I think the answer is already given in Justine's, but I would like to elaborate on that. Why? So basically, the classical idea of secularism is a separation between state and religion. In European case, it's clearly the state and the church. Why it doesn't work, and why we cannot use the term separation for the case of the relation between the state and religion in communist country or in the communist world is precisely because as a historical project that is that every communist state aimed to carry out in order to basically assure its role as the only authority and also the one that would control other possible authority that like religious authority, communist state, in order to control religion, it actually end up interacting with religion a lot more than it originally planned to. So there's no way separation can happen. And also, in many other traditions, like the case of Vietnam or China, where the presence of popular religion is so dominant, there are also what Weberian scholar would call one religion in this country, but popular religion is equally or in some case even more important than formal religion. In order to make that separation happen, you need a well-defined religion. But in this case like Vietnam, China, where popular religion is the dominant mode of religiosity in society, instead of making a separation with it, a communist state often have to do the dirty work of creating a form of popular religion before they can separate themselves from it. So as we know, this mingling between communist millenarians' idea and the populist and popular religions' millenarian idea in China and Vietnam often mingle with each other and create a very interesting kind of tango on the ground between these two parties. No way to separate them.
Yeah. It's interesting, but I think both of you are anthropologists, aren't you?
Yes.
It's interesting to me as a historian that this historical investigation of the genesis of these various forms of secularism has been driven largely by anthropologists and by anthropology. You know, the most famous figure is probably Talal Asad, an anthropologist now in New York. Just curious, like, why is it that anthropology as a field why is it particularly perhaps well suited to this work of, you know, looking at these entangled relations between the state and religion?
Well, I think that partially has to do with the fact that Talal Asad was one of the figures, as an anthropologist, he called back in 1993 for an anthropology of secularism, and his audience was primarily anthropologists, and we have attempted to rise to the challenge. But for two reasons. One of the most obvious reasons is that we tend to work in places where secularism isn't as easy to take for granted. I think a lot of 20th century sociology and political science sort of assumed that secularism was the status quo, that it was a social good, and they didn't really think about it as anything other than just this sort of simple idea of separating church and state, which is a good thing, and that's it. Anthropologists have a tendency to work in places where that project is much, much harder to carry out. So we see the friction that comes into play when you're trying to institute a secular regime in a place that doesn't fit. So it becomes, the logic of the system becomes more evident. But also just methodologically, anthropologists are interested in the texture of everyday life. We're interested in the details, and something which in the West is such a sort of background idea is really hard to quantify. It's something people don't think about very often. And so you need this kind of detailed, textured microanalysis in order to even find it. And I think that's why anthropology was at the forefront of trying to do that. And now that hopefully anthropologists have been working on it for a while, it's going to be something that one can then back out and generalize about maybe and quantify. But it's really hard to see if you're not looking at micro examples.
The other, you know, disciplinary influence that I see in the secularism studies has been post-colonial theory, which, you know, anthropologists are involved in as well. But nonetheless, the post-colonial approach, if you so will, has been absolutely central in the development of this interest in secularism. Do you want to say something about that? Why has that context been particularly important?
Well, for me, as someone who worked on a post-colonial society, I see only the obvious reason why secularism is central to any anthropological study of religion in post-colonial society for various reasons. So one, for example, I could think of is Basically, the relation between the state and religion in post-colonial society like Vietnam is defined deeply and largely by the colonial history of the country. In so many ways take for example the case of Catholicism in Vietnam. The way that the state deal with this religion is ununderstandable if one does not look into the history of French intervention in Vietnam and the role of the Catholic Church in the entire period of colonial history, and also when the Viet Minh or the Vietnamese try to see independent and what they perceive of the role of the Catholic Church. So these are one example. The other example that Jane Winner or Evan Grant is discussing for the case of Vietnam or Laos is that the very policy carried out by the French in Laos and in Vietnam is continued by the state of Laos and Vietnam towards a very different religious group. So it is a continuity of the secular project that started in Europe and is taken over by the post-colonial society. So when we study such a society, we have to take into account this global phenomenon of secularization. Yes.
And you know, I said at the beginning that this book, I think, is important because it brings in a new perspective. You know, it seems to me that there's been a bit of a blind spot in also in post-colonial studies when dealing with communist regimes. It seems that most of the examples have looked at the transition from, you know, the colonial era into some type of whatever, the post-colonial independent, you know, largely capitalistic systems of say, India or other countries. My question there is, you know, in what way, in a general sense, is the communist and post-communist experience of secularism different? I realize that's a huge question, but maybe we can take a stab at that. What might readers who are familiar with books by Talal Asad discover in your book that they might not have known?
Well, what's interesting, I mean, what's different about communism, about secularism in the communist world is really fairly self-evident. And that's part of why I think the communist world was so often excluded. In Western liberal secular states, the goal is, as we discussed before, the separation of church and state. And so there's this idea of privatized religion. Religion stays in its private sphere and keeps out of the public sphere. That's the realm of the state. And as you know, that doesn't work in the communist world, right? For the communist ideology, religion is a problem. Even there is no private sphere in the same way that there is in the West, in sort of Western liberal ideology. The private is the political, and even privatized religion is a problem. So the goal is, of course, the complete eradication of religion from social life, which, you know, that's the ideological goal. It very clearly was never achieved. What I think, and because of that, for the most part, people would talk about state-sponsored atheism or state-imposed atheism and not so much use the word secularism. What's really interesting, I think, is not the difference, but rather the immense similarities, because the political views of what religion is and why it's a problem come out of the exact same Enlightenment philosophical project that produced Western secularism. A lot of the discourse about religion is an antiquated frame for explaining the world that will be superseded by science. That is very similar in the two places. The idea of producing, as Tam was saying earlier, right, in order to separate church and state, you have to produce the right kind of church and the right kind of state, right? Very often, communist regimes would take very Western models of what's a religion in order to try and suppress it. And it didn't work because they were dealing with religions that didn't fit into those parameters. So what's actually really interesting is not so much how the communist world is different, but actually how similar they are, despite the fact that the ultimate goal of eradicating religion from the public sphere entirely is very different from the goal, the political goals in Western secularism. So what I think people who are used to looking at studies of secularism in the US, in France, in India, in the Islamic world, will find when they look at the communist world is a lens through which they can see some of the things, some of the discourses and some of the practices that are also going on in Western secularism through a slightly different lens. Because they are, in fact, a lot more similar than one would expect.
Much of the book, I think, is really dealing with the last, say, 30 years, 40 years of history, right? So I mean, a great interest here has been really this transition around 1989, 90, 91, from sort of Tiananmen Square to the fall of the Berlin Wall to the collapse of the Soviet Union. Okay, I just want to throw out a sort of assumption, a naive assumption from somebody who doesn't know the literature very well. One could assume, let's say, that the decline of communism was marked by a failure of a utopian ideology, and that with the failure of the utopian ideology comes a rebirth of religion, and hence conversion to Christianity in many Asian countries, new religious movements in the Soviet Union, and so on. You can use any examples, really, I think, from your book, but is that a valid notion, or how would you problematize that?
Well, I think what you mentioned is also what crossed our mind, but I do think that since one of the arguments that the book and the collection of essays trying to say that secularism is a historical project, not a historical process. So it is still working. It is still going on. It never really get to its goal, its ideological goal, that is basically reaching this complete, right? But this moment of 1989 and 91 really bring our change, in which I could think of, for example, on the assumption about religion and communism that we have up to that point was produced by the influence of Cold War politics. Whether this assumption really the case in reality, we don't know for sure, because despite of the quite last literature we have on religion and Cold War, we do not know yet on the ground whether secularism or atheist secularism was already achieving its goal in various communist societies. So that's why we thought it also a moment when we met each other and reviewing the literature, we really think that it is time now to re-question these assumptions from that were made in the 90s when scholars freshly have access to Russia, to China, and making this assumption based on what they understand of the influence of Cold War politics on this society. The other side, there's another reason why I think these moments are important, because it is connecting to a change, a fundamental change in politics in various communist society. In Russia, for example, in Russia and other Eastern European, it was official ending of communist regime. Therefore, the state, although we all know that there's still continuity of certain form of power and ruling in this place. But the form of discourse can no longer be the one that was ruling before this moment anymore. So it was not a communist country that take Russia, for example, that is still imposing certain rule when it comes to dealing with religion. In country like Vietnam or China, where the communist regime continues, still there is immense change, because with the collapse of the Soviet Union, Vietnam and China, for example, have to refigure its international relation, external relation, as well as internal relation. So externally, Vietnam and China both want to become a part of the global economy, with export, with World Trade Organization, and with that, Vietnam and China have to comply with the demand from Western world, say leading by the United States when it comes to regulation about religious freedom, for example. So the relation between the state and religion have to change. And also internally, driving economic reform are forces that would take away the attention to certain religious practices. So things that was banned or defined as superstition before now are no longer seen the same after 1989 or 1991. Then the third important issue here is how in this post-socialist country, when the legitimation of the ruler of the communist state is fading away, the way to mobilize nationalist movement or action is to ironically employ religion. So in Vietnam or China or Laos, religion become the heart of national identity, become a kind of sacred heritage that on which the protection of national sovereignty is defined. So you see, these things only happen or coming out into place thanks to this monumental change in 1989 with the collapse of the Soviet Union, and 1991 when reformed is feeling strongly in certain parts of the world like Vietnam and China.
You know, I wanted to follow up on that, what you were just saying about the way that the state determines which religions are considered superstitious or somehow negative, which ones they want to assimilate. And I was struck, there's several essays about China. And the one particularly by, I think, Dan Smiryu, he looks at really three factors: the state and its scientific atheism, the rise of Protestantism in particular, and Buddhism. And he sort of compares, there's a comparison in there in the way that the state approaches Christianity on the one hand and Buddhism on the other. And I suppose even something that's in the edge would be some kind of, folk practices. So could you give me just a bit of a detail about how the Chinese state, sort of picks and chooses when it interacts with these various religions, and how it, what that tells us about contemporary Chinese secularism.
Okay. So, yes, I think the essay by Dan and also in many ways by Qi Zhe help us to understand what is going on with Chinese communism and Chinese religiosity. And I think the argument here again returns to this previous question about the impact of colonialism in China. China never been colonized, but the impact of Peter Van der Veer called imperial encounters is so strong in the intellectual debate in the country, in the ways that it results till today in the state approach toward different world religion. So Certainly, well, as we all know, how Chinese government sort of classify different type of Christianity. Some, so the state approved church is encouraged and getting a lot of space to maneuver to produce result and create action in society. But those who belong to house church or to a new basically new growth a Christian group in the country is tightly under control because of the very idea about religion and subversion it could produce. And on the other hand, Buddhism is something very similar to Vietnam, that the state, when it have to come to choose between religion, Buddhism somehow stand on a very good ground. In China case, it is complicated because Buddhism, there are some brand of Buddhism is clearly not favorable by the state. That is, for example, Tibetan Buddhism. But Dan's research also shows us that even within Tibetan Buddhism, there is a progress not every Tibetan Buddhist group are discriminated, but some are now gaining enormous popularity. So what we I think any conclusion we can make about such case is that neither the communist state or religion in this country stay static, but they progress and interact, and it's very hard to make a conclusion about its relation, their relation, at any point in time.
Yeah, good. So on the point about the scientific atheism, what is the position of the Chinese state? There's an argument I think made by both of those authors, Xi Zhe and Dan Suiyu, about the kind of during the Mao era there was this tremendous utopian energy contained within the ideology, and it's sort of what has happened to that particular ideology that was driving a lot of this earlier secularism. What are the remnants today of that? How do we observe that?
Do you want to get into to answer that, Justine? Or?
Sure. In part because some of my research addresses that as well. I think, there's a number of different ways in which that ideology leaves remnants, both in how the state approaches things, as well as in how people practice, which is one of the more interesting questions. So, for example, Dan Suiyu talks about this sort of scientific apologetics, the way in which religions try and argue, use scientific proof to justify their practices. That's certainly a very strong strain in Buddhism, not just in China or say in Buryatia where I work, but also like Tibetan Buddhism more broadly, makes arguments about how it is compatible with science. It's a scientific philosophy. That's certainly this idea of skepticism and trying to marshal scientific proof for religious practices and religious belief is very common in the area that I work. There's a lot of discussion about scientific proof and an idea about skepticism in the sense that like we're not just believers, we are skeptics, and so we marshal evidence in order to believe. And that I think is very much still a habit that comes out of this kind of modern secular subjectivities that were being crafted by communist states. Another really interesting example is in Matthias Pelkman's chapter about Kyrgyzstan, where Islam is definitely reviving as a source of national tradition, right? And had been acknowledged as a source of national tradition throughout the Soviet period and tolerated, precisely co-opted, controlled by the state, but also tolerated as national tradition. Now is coming in the post-Soviet period, right? One of the big things that changed in it from like 89 to 91, I mean, all the things that Tam mentioned in that transition, but we also have to add to it, right? You have 75 years of the communist states defining religion as the anti-ideology. And then you have an influx of missionaries. So in Kyrgyzstan, in Matthias Pelkman's chapter, there are very conservative Islamist missionaries coming into Kyrgyzstan. And there's a certain pushback from the admittedly Muslim population there, but they identify someone as atheist Muslims, saying, no, but this isn't the kind of religion that we think you should practice, right? They actually have tremendous, like, not just that they believe in the separation of church and state, but the habits in which they assume how churches should behave are grounded in a very secular assumption about separation of church and state. And so what the missionaries are trying to do seems very offensive because it rubs up against these secular habits of people who are identify as religious, but that's not the way religion is supposed to act in this place. So those are two very strong habits, I think, that people have retained from the Soviet period. This idea that religion is a place where national tradition lives, but religions need to behave in certain ways. And this sort of skeptical attitude towards belief that tries to invoke scientific arguments in defense of faith. And in a sense, sort of, to keep, right, because the Soviet period, Soviet ideology very, very much associates religion with the past, right? Religion is a survival, it's a backwards kind of practice, and a modern person is going to leave all of this backwardness behind. So on the one hand, people are very attracted to religion because the Soviet state or the communist state in China and Vietnam spent so much time defining it as the enemy. Right. And then the ideology kind of falls apart. You're like, oh, let's check out this thing that was always defined as the enemy. But at the same time, they're very reluctant to give up their self-identification as modern subjects. And modern subjects are not really religious subjects. So that produces a tension in how they practice religion that I think very much carries over from the communist period.
Well, may I add a little bit to that? There is, in Vietnam, the same issue is taking a much higher level, much further in it's to me really amazing that instead of being the enemy of science, religion in Vietnam nowadays practiced by many different groups are incorporating religion. So, for example, we have this new movement in Vietnam, which I broadly define as spiritist movement, which involve the top-ranking scientists. For example, the founder of quantum physics in Vietnam, a professor trained in Russia, or the director of Pasteur Institute, the number one virologist in Vietnam now, leading figure in this spiritist movement. So instead of seeing religion as belonging to the past or what the communist state defined as superstitious and backward, religion is the future. The tool of science become a tool to find proof and enhance religious experience. So we have this, for example, Society of Telepaths in Vietnam, who not only wear a scientific uniform like, linguists talk very similar to what linguists describe of what happened in Russia. In Vietnam, they modify a metal detector machine to search for soul. And born, they use quantum physics to argue for the existence of the soul. They use the latest research in laboratory research about virus and virology to prove the material base of human soul and ghost. So this thing definitely can be seen as remnant of communist promotion of science and suppression of religion. But at the same time, one can also say that this is a continuum of that mentalities it had to be scientific to be magical.
Uh-huh. You know, just to follow up on this idea of the remnants of the communist project, how when you talk about the these efforts to marry science to these religious practices or religious innovations, to what degree is the state always involved, and does it tend to always be involved on the side that is trying to bring science into the equation? In other words, how central is the state in the evolution of these types of syncretic movements, such as you've just described?
Well, in the case of Vietnam, the state has its hand very tight here, because on the one hand, what people are doing is still broadly religious, and of course, with being religious, it also have this very zealous moment, which will create social and political action that is not entirely what the state wants, because in the end, communist control is very much relying on certain line about social stability and order, and religious practitioner, albeit scientists, scientific or non-scientific, often overstepping that. So, for example, in Vietnam, this telepathic society, leading by top-ranking scientists, they are often making demand and comment on political situation using the voice of the spirit that they invoke through laboratorial tests to make comments about current government policy and so on. These things are not something that authorities in Vietnam are happy about. But on the other hand, these scientists are, and their so-called discovery is also a way of face-saving for a lot of political authority in Vietnam, for the very fact that they, being in power, they themselves are also inclined towards certain religious action and answer when it comes to political decisions. So if science can prove that it is that it exists, but it appears scientific, then it's kind of is a kind of face saving. But long and short, the state play a very sometimes quite passive role in this development. It is the people that carry out this leading the movement, and it's often getting into conflict with the state.
There's a similar example in Victor Schnurlman's chapter, for example, that happened in Russia. And the parallels are, this was one of these like parallels where where we're sitting around at lunch talking and thinking, wow, this is the same stuff happening in one place or another. So in Victor Schnurlman's chapter, he writes about the Soviet state was trying to suppress Christianity and foster state rituals and public rituals that were grounded in sort of pre-Christian Russian pagan practices as a way of making them less religious, right? To the state, these sort of folk religious practices seemed less religious and a better way of grounding national sentiment and national feeling. So they promoted these sort of folk festivals, and they were so popular that they ended up sparking a kind of neo-pagan revolution and neo-pagan movement that ended up taking a very anti-state stance. So in a sense, it was an attempt to by the state to foster something that they thought was safe, ends up taking off and kind of positioning itself against the state and becoming a problem for the state. So precisely as Tam said, these things, that's one of the reasons why this idea of separation of church and state, it's an ideal, but in practice, there's so much intertwining and such ambiguous positions that it's much more productive to look at the ways in which state and religious practices kind of feed into each other and produce unexpected consequences.
Well, it would seem that the legacy really of this interventionism without bounds from the early communist era, you know, established a precedent in terms of state intervention, so that you have a very dynamic situation when it comes to religion. It would seem from reading the essays, you know, that even this example of the folkish religion being developed by the state and then escaping the bounds of the state, it nonetheless has part of its origin in this intervention by the state into religious traditions and religious politics. So the other thing that pops up repeatedly, and also that I as a reader brought to this question of religion in post-communist societies, is the issue of nationalism. You know, there's been influential articles in Soviet history. I'm thinking of Yuri Slezkin, you know, arguing really that with the Second World War, the Soviet Union stopped being an internationalist communist regime and really became a nationalist Russian, great Russian regime. Just curious, you know, thinking about your project, how does nationalism fit into this negotiation between the state and religions?
You want to go for it, Justine?
Sure. The idea of nationalism and this was one of the themes that emerged as being a really clear idea that carries through everything, and that I think also provides a very productive point of comparison back to Western liberal secularism. Talal Asad makes the argument in one of his articles that secularism is intimately tied to the nation state form because it's one of the ways in which you can ground a state identity, right? Religion is sort of an individualistic thing. So if you want to try and ground a state identity that's encompasses diversity, secularism is an essential part of doing that. And I'm not sure that necessarily carries over perfectly into the communist world, but the ubiquity of the nation state form, and even, I mean, there's a tension in the Soviet Union all the way through between internationalist aspirations and just the habit of the nation state form. It's certainly there in a lot of the post-colonial states as well, this idea that this is just the only way to imagine a state. And so the religions that are able to kind of occupy the space of national religion have to be accommodated and dealt with in a way that you can't. You have to negotiate with them. Whereas like missionary religions, things that are seen as foreign, things that can be written off as superstition, can be suppressed in a very different way than ones that can make claims on national tradition. And the need to produce rituals to sort of bolster national forms and national identities also seems to have been a universal point across all of these states, and doesn't seem to be something that any of them were willing to sort of abandon.
Yeah, and also if we notice that at the very beginning of Benedict Anderson's books about nationalism, he comment on the war between Vietnam and China in 1979 as a clear sign that in the end nationalism is still the force that drives the national and international politics, not international communism, as for decades Russia, China, Vietnam declare, or what's the opponent, the capitalist won't believe that believe in the importance of international communism. This example between Vietnam and China going as two communist brothers going at war with each other, showing that nationalism will is the strongest force, and it will employ any other forces within the nation and beyond in order to regenerate its vitalities. And in Vietnam, nowadays, how religion play a role in the nationalist project is just so clear. For example, recently Vietnam and China is again engaging in some territorial dispute in which various religious group in Vietnam are also taking part in it for example Buddhist group dispatching monks to Rocky Islands in order to take a national claim, put a sacred stamp on the national territories. Spiritist group in the city going to borderland areas to pray, to invoke the soul of the ancient Vietnamese ancestor to protect the nation from the enemy, and so on. The Vietnamese government are nominating various religious traditions that formerly defined as illegal and superstition as national heritage and apply for the UNESCO heritage status, and so on. These are some among many examples about how religion, instead of being the enemy of the state, now is actually the column of national identity. And like I mentioned previously, that whole politic of heritageization of religion nowadays is what defines the role between religion and communist state. And also in Russia, we can see that how Putin is taking a very close relationship with the Orthodox Church. In our books, Agnieszka describes the continuing important role of the Catholic Church in the whole history of Poland after the Second World War until today. So definitely religion is now one of the core components of nationalism in many of these communist countries.
Yeah, I was just thinking of this essay by Haeyonik Kwon about North Korea's war memorials, and it's a wonderful comparison looking at the war memorials in South Korea and North Korea. And, you know, I think that that's really what your book offers, even, you know, in this one article, this comparison, but you really open up to comparisons with many different countries, which is why I think it's going to be very useful, to many people. So I have some final question for both of you, but before I ask, I'm just curious if you want to highlight any of the essays that you find, you know, particularly compelling, or some topic that maybe we haven't touched on.
Well, I think one of the things that's important to know about the book as a whole is that one of the reasons why the essays work so well together is, in fact, because they came out of an actual conversation, right? So the conversation started between Tam and I over lunch at the Institute, but eventually opened up into a workshop. We had a call for papers. We got an overwhelming response. We got like 120 proposals. From that, we narrowed it down, and everyone that contributed to the book, as well as a number of other people, came to a workshop at the Max Planck, and all of them had written their papers. Everyone, the papers were circulated in advance. We read each other's papers. We talked about each other's papers over the course of a couple of days, and then everyone took those conversations home to revise their chapters. So when we say the chapters are in conversation with each other, they really are. All the authors were in the same room arguing about each other's points before they went home to make the final revisions. And I think that's one of the real strengths of the book. A lot of edited volumes are just sort of collections of things that people came across. This is really organically produced out of a conversation. Despite the fact that we have a lot of different topics, so we have a couple of chapters. So Jane Werner's chapter on the history of cooperation with Vietnam. We have Grant Evans' chapter about Buddhism in Laos. Agnieszka's chapter about Poland and Xu Jie's chapter about China. Those are all chapters where we look at that look at the ways in which the state cooperated with religious forms. Sonia Luhrmann's chapter, I mean, you just mentioned Honit Kwan's, which looks at cemeteries. Sonia Luhrmann's chapter is really, I think, a fantastic chapter because it gets to one of the core debates that we had at the workshop, which is this longstanding question of, is communism a religion? Is it productive to look at it as a religion? And she offers a different lens on that question, which is, let's look at communism versus religion in terms of levels of transcendence, right? What kinds of transcendence does it aspire to? And that allows you to make comparisons without choosing sides, right? It's not communism is a religion and it's not a religion, but look at this way in which it's kind of like one, but also different.
Yeah, I'm very sympathetic.
That's really productive.
I'm very sympathetic to that approach because, I find the problem with political religion, which is a theory that pops up as well in some of the pages, it takes religion to be a norm, usually looking at Catholicism as an example, and then compares everything to, ecclesiastical structures and eschatological frameworks, and then everything becomes then a merely one form of Western Christianity. So finding some way to make comparisons without relying on that, I think, is very useful.
And that is also precisely what Adam Chow in his article contribute, that he basically point out a common truth that a lot of study about religion and secularism today, anthropologically or other or from other discipline, tend to play too much importance on this, the relation between on church state relation, whereas religious practices in many places, especially in Asia, is carrying out in a much more diverse form and by diverse actor. So he, in the case of China, for example, he highlights the role of the family, the household, as a critical unit, actually the most critical unit in continuing or discontinuing certain kind of religious practice and behavior. And I think this nuances, anthropological perspective is something that's very helpful to provide a fuller understanding of religion and communism relation in China and elsewhere.
Yeah, I would agree. Most of our authors, not all of them, but most of the authors that contributed are anthropologists, in part because that's precisely that kind of like everyday life texture that you find different perspectives. So again, I agree. Adam Chow's chapter is great because it offers this other perspective. There's also a chapter by Klimona Antonova, who's an art historian who looks at how people relate to icons in post-Soviet Russia as a way of sort of getting to that different perspective on how people practice. So all of the chapters have that kind of texture of everyday life that enables different ways of getting at the question.
And I would just add, though, that I think that what's interesting about, in general, this is true of the literature on secularism, but the fact that the state is always absolutely central in the analysis, I think, is something that really allows this type of work to be very useful to, say, historians, political theorists, and so on. So, I think that is something that really opens it up for other readers as well. Great. Well, this has been a really fascinating discussion, and I think that hopefully people who are listening to this will realize that we haven't even scratched the surface. we've just looked at the surface a little bit of this book. So there's just so much in it that I hope people will go and have a look for themselves. So the final question that we always like to ask is just to give us a little bit of a look forward, something about what you're working on now. Maybe future projects.
Go ahead, Justin. I come after you.
Okay. Well, I just sent a book manuscript off for review, so wish me luck.
Hooray.
And which looks at different rituals in Buryatia, which, as I said, is a autonomous republic in South Central Siberia. One of the things that happens around 1989 is that these sort of dominant historical narratives supported by the state fall apart, and ritual, both civic ritual as well as predominantly religious ritual, becomes a place where people can explore different histories and different stories about the past of the place that they're in. So I look at different rituals in that book as a way of telling different alternative histories of this place. And I'm currently also working on what I've been working on for a very long time is the revival of shamanism in Buryatia, and especially the tendency in the post-Soviet period to try and make shamanism an institutional religion, which traditionally has, well, I hate the word traditional, right? This is something that they constantly argue about. People say, is it traditional? Is it not? It was with Genghis Khan. And but increasingly, there are these shamans organizations that are building churches and trying to institutionalize that practice. And so I'm trying to look at that process, actually beginning in the late Soviet period, when there's an increasing academic interest in shamanism, all the way up through now, where this revival meets with a global New Age interest in shamanism and in reviving these kinds of practices for a much broader global audience. So that's what I'm working on. Tam?
Yes. Well, I have so many things that I'm working on, but just like Justine, yes, I just finished a book which will come out in June in print this year. So very excited. That's my first book about, based on my PhD research on this massive Protestant conversion among the Hmong in the border of Vietnam and China. The Hmong is about 1 million people population in Vietnam, and this conversion is very kind of peculiar because it were carried out not by missionary encounters or human interaction, but it was initiated by radio, by the broadcasting work of the FIES Broadcasting Company, a U.S.-based massive radio ministry that also operate in Eastern Europe, Russia, and very, very big in Asia. And they broadcast this Christian proselytization section aiming at China. The whole effort have a lot of Cold War history in there. Also, this whole idea about the Far East as one of the places where the devil inhabit. But the signal were accidentally caught by the Hmong on the mountain of Vietnam, who take this Christian message at heart. But because they also believe, they are also practice a form of Hmong millenarianism. So when they hear Christian message, they thought it is a message about their return Messias, and they convert. They follow millenarian action before they convert to Christianity. But unfortunately, their conversion come up against so much obstacle by the state, because the Vietnamese government see not only the Hmong as a minority with trouble, but also because of their relation with the Vietnam War. You know, half of the Hmong in Laos fight with the American army, and the other half fight with the communists. So with the history of the group and then Christianity being brought by radio in the time that radio is still seen as an instrument of imperial forces like America. So altogether, state authority has tried for 2 decades to stem this religious movement. But in the end, it wasn't successful, because nowadays there is about 1/3 of Hmong in Vietnam who defy the so as Christian. So my book describes the movement from the beginning until today, and the identity politics that it is shaped by this bizarre global Christianity interaction with native Messiahs millennialism. So that is all done, and I'm excited that finally the 10-year project is out soon. And currently, since 2011, I have been working on two projects. That is a clear continuation of my interest in the relation between religion and communism in so many ways. The first project, as you I mentioned a little bit about it at the beginning of the introductory essay in this book, with Justine, that is a movement in Vietnam to form the religion of Ho Chi Minh. So you know, Ho Chi Minh died some 40-50 years ago, and after he died, the Vietnamese communist state has made him into a sort of godly figure of a national founder. And they printed his teaching out like the way a Christian church deliver a Bible to people. In the last 20 years, this state practiced to deify Ho Chi Minh is taken seriously by rural uneducated women and many other supporters who are scientists, like I mentioned, you know, the scientists turned spiritists in Vietnam. And this movement grew like wildfire with tens of thousands of followers in many provinces. And they organize ritual days. Week is a way of appropriating communist holidays. And they staged a lot of public performances and got into constant conflict with the state. And now, So in this book project, which I'm writing, I hope to use this case of on the one hand, state promotion, a personal cult of a communist leader, how it interact with the popular appropriation of this very cult, but add the religious flavor to it. So that's one project. The other project I'm looking at is the question of human body and human remains in the sort of like if you want to do a social autopsy of Vietnamese society after civil war that the country experienced or gone through in 20th century, there are millions of human bones missing all over Vietnam, thanks to the war against France, the war against America, and the war between Vietnam and China in 1979. And the Vietnamese is strong believer in the practice of secondary burial. So the need to discover and repatriate this bone home to rebury them properly according to religious ritual is something that every Vietnamese take serious. But after the Vietnam War, Vietnamese government imposed a very strict norm on commemoration and post-war memory politics. So it's not easy for everybody to just go around and look for bone. After the moment that American government reconnect with Vietnamese government in order to relocate the bone of about 2,000 American soldiers still missing in Vietnam, then various social forces in Vietnam tap onto the opportunity provided by that moment to bring back a traditional practice of connecting the soul and relocating bone using spirit medium. So in this second project, I look at the interaction between science and religious practice in solving the question of post-war trauma and religious imagination of the country after this violent century.
Wow. Well, those sound like fascinating projects, and I'm thinking of switching my discipline and becoming anthropologist.
Please do join us.
Okay, I might. Be careful of the competition, though. Anyway, I know that Justine has to run off to class. So I just wanted to thank you both for being here and talking to us. I'm sure that listeners will have found this a very interesting conversation, as I did, and hopefully we'll have a look at your various essays in your edited book. And perhaps when your books are finished, we can have another conversation.
That would be lovely.
Yes.
Thank Thank you so much for having us on and for reading the book and for introducing it to potential readers. We really appreciate the opportunity.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Yes, thank you. And we got to talk about apologetic realism seriously.
Yes. Okay, thank you.